Wi-Fi party line.
Welcome to another episode of the Sci-Fi Party Line podcast. This is your hostess, Kat, and this is part two of our Avatar adventure. Today, we're going to talk about special effects. I have Will.
Hello.
Uh-huh. It's me. I have Eric.
Hey.
And welcome back, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going?
Yay, everything's going, pretty good. We're all pretty excited about Avatar, and I really want to hear, you know, you guys are special effects, Will and Ryan. Eric is heavy on the audio and just general movie buff, James Cameron fanboy, and so we're just going to really get into it and talk about the special effects.
As am I. I'm a James Cameron buff myself.
Okay, well, good. That's awesome. Okay, so this movie was very pretty. Go.
Yes.
Yes, it was pretty.
Okay, next Ryan. Ryan.
Yeah.
What? Why? Why is this movie so special?
Well, I don't think it's for the story. I was telling somebody earlier that it was the simplest movie ever made in the most complicated way ever made. There's nothing to the story. I mean, it's a story we've probably all heard or seen, or if we watch Dances with Wolves, know pretty well. But besides all of that, we've never seen a movie made this way or shot this way or done this way at all. Partially, I'd say one of the biggest things is that James Cameron found a way to make 3D not a gimmick. He made it something that's absolutely essential for these kind of movies going forward. I've never been in a movie before where I felt like I was literally 10 feet in front of the camera that was shooting it instead of behind the camera next to the director. I literally felt like I was in the middle of Pandora the whole time. And I know a lot of people were really, really skeptical about that, myself included, because we've all seen the 3D stereoscopic movies, the computer animated ones. Some have done really well, some have been really cheesy. But I've never seen a live action one that either didn't give people a headache or people just wondered, why is it even shot this way? And this is the one that first answered that question, I think. I want to go back to Pandora after seeing the movie two or three times. So to me, that was the first thing, is that the beautiful part of it was that the technology was used to add to the story. There's parts of the story that it's obvious that it's an environmental story. It's a green story. And to make you really believe that, putting you in the place of the most important character of the whole movie, being the environment, that was probably the most important thing for me that worked really, really well. The characters also, but I thought the environment was the thing that was kind of the hero of the entire thing. I don't know how, did you guys feel the way too?
Yeah, I want to buy a ticket. I want to go to Pandora now.
Yeah, I want the theme park built immediately. If we can find a way to build the theme park, like whoever has to do it, sign it up right away.
with the flying inverted screw bugs, I love those. But like they fly, they fly like the sketches of Leonardo da Vinci. They're very cool.
Yeah, I want those flowers that pop up and down like that.
Those are cool. I like those flowers. I like all of the environment. And you're right. You explain to somebody the movie. This is the idea of Avatar. You explain it to them, they go, yeah. So, and you can't really go, well, you know, because yeah, you're right. There's nothing to explain. But as I tweeted Friday morning, very early Friday morning after I saw the Midnight Show on Thursday in IMAX 3D, it was, I got about halfway through the movie and I said to myself, my God, I would watch the phone book being dictated if I had these effects with it. Because it was so
okay, guys.
Amazing, explain,
but Will, let's stop for a second. I don't think a lot of people knew what they were watching. I don't think they understand the tech involved in making the world and the faces and stuff. I thought maybe people think, you know, they just sat in front of a computer, made these people, made the faces, you know, emote, and that was it.
Explain to us. That. Yeah,
explain. And Ryan, jump in on this too, because I know you guys both.
Well, it's the basic concept. The name of what James did in the movie is performance capture, up for motion capture, because basically you get a big actor doing what the performance art, doing what a motion actor would do for the mocap. Mocap is used a lot, and I heard them talking the other day. And somebody said, oh, wow, it's this new amazing technology called motion capture. And I went, yeah, they invented motion capture in 1963 for the characters for Imagineering characters at Disneyland.
And even before that, they did motion capture for 2D animated stuff, you know, like Snow White. I mean, it was rotoscoping, but it's essentially the same thing.
I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I should say that's electronic motion capture. They actually had a suit which had all the potentiometers for each joint, and it could it could move everything. And I was walking, and I looked, 1963. I went, oh my God, it's that old? The technology's that old. But so what it is you have a suit. You're in a Lycra suit, and the suit has basically points on it that are white that can be really easily read against black. I've heard that it was digital, meaning you're out there and your suit transmits back to a base how your elbows are moved or your hand is moved or any of that. And that is, I don't know if that's that or if it was the tracking balls is what they call it, that were used on like Gollum and things like that creature and that stuff. But the interesting thing about and James Cameron looked at this and he said it was cool. And then he said, but there are not things about it that aren't cool. And one of the things, because that's the same technology, exactly the same technology that is used in the Roger Zemeckis uses for Polar Express and Monster House and Christmas Carol. And if you look at those characters in Beowulf, and if you look at those characters in that show, they look so amazingly cool, except like when you look at their eyes. Mm-hmm. And there's no emotion in their eyes at all. They are dead characters. They are dead characters. They have no emotion. And how many times in this movie, there were sections where they had conversations between the two main characters with looks, where she gives a look at him and he gives like a look at her and she looks at him again and then they run off. And it's just like, you knew exactly what they were talking about, what was happening, what emotion was coming through those characters because of the emotion on their faces.
So do you think that's true. And so do you think that because the movie was so perfect in that way that it was lost on people?
I think it might be so good at doing that that it might have people going, yeah, everyone does that. I mean, why wouldn't that be? No, because that's a computer-generated image. Computer-generated images don't do that. So what they did to do that, to create that emotion, was he got a rig, a head rig for them. It was basically it was a small camera that shot back up their face, you know, back at them. So it was low enough so that they could see everything they were looking at. And then this camera was below them, and it was attached to their head. So wherever they looked, the camera was looking at their face. And they would put little dots on their head to catch all that emotion. And it actually did mo-capture on their faces. And
so on their faces, or...?
There are dots on their faces, and they roughly translate to morph points. You know what morphing is, of course.
Yeah.
And then you have the motion on your face, and then you can track that. And then he had a ton of data. He had all the data of the motion. He had all the data of the face capture and the motion capture, and he puts this in the computer. But that wasn't the end of the story. And if you go out and look at James Cameron has said on several different interviews and different occasions, on the CNN thing, on the 60 Minutes thing, it was, and then the artist took over. this Zemeckis's, I know this is Zemeckis's point of view. He has said on several times that we don't need artists. We don't need them at all because we got all this, and this puts it in there, and bam, it's magical stuff. And I don't think he understands how that process works. The process that he's trying to ape works. And James Cameron, artist, illustrator, does. And he always, always, always brings in the artist to this process. And it's because all that data and all the motion capture and all the facial capture doesn't necessarily line up, doesn't necessarily work, and has problems and has things that they miss. Because it's a human technology. It just misses something. And you know, and I know, and I'm sure Ryan knows, even Eric knows that. Wow. I was kidding. I want to choke Eric. But
okay, well, let me go into Eric. What did you hold up, Will?
It's the artist's hand at that point. It's the artist's hand. Sorry.
It's the Hans. Okay, Eric, how did this movie sound to you? Or look to the look and the sound or the feel or anything like that.
All right. Well, you know, this is what I've been saying since I saw it on Friday. And I know this is a bold statement to some people when they hear this, and they may think I'm just losing it. But I'm pretty firm, and we'll see how I feel about it months from now, but I'm pretty firm right now that this has to be probably the greatest cinematic spectacle that's come out during my lifetime. Has to be. And I came, and just for reference, it's about the last 32 years since the original Star Wars. I've really been trying to rack my brain. There's been other great spectacle movies, of course. Let's see, off the top of my head, Terminator 2, Jurassic Park, Matrix, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars prequels, all that. Yeah, it's all great, and they had baby steps, you know, that they moved, you know, in advancing, like, cinematic technology. But this, wow, this is leaps and bounds all at once. It's just so dramatic. So, and it hits on every level. It hits and pops on every level. The visual aspect, the motion capture, the CGI, most definitely the 3D. Yeah, a lot of the 3D visuals right now, those are hitting me as the most, like, amazing. I mean, there's all the other stuff is amazing too, like what we were just talking about with the motion capture. But to me, the 3D is the most shocking thing because those other examples of motion capture, you know, I've seen before, and you can kind of see at least the progression in that. Like if you look at like the Zemeckis movies and Gollum and things like that. You can see the progression from that to the motion capture in Avatar. But the 3D, I don't see any progression. I see a huge leap from the 3D that we've already seen. Even with the recent 3D movies, there's still a lot.
How exactly?
Well, you know, we kind of talked about it before, but because, for instance, Up looks great in 3D, of course, and Coraline. And, you know, it's like you're looking at it's like you're in the digital painting of Up, or you're seeing like the actual 3D models of Coraline in front of your face. But and see, it's gonna take more time to absorb it and watch it over Avatar in 3D. But because again, there's so much, you can't really take it all in one go. There's a lot more 3D within the 3D of Avatar. As I was saying earlier, Kat, one of the things that and a lot of it's a side eye candy. So I'm not surprised a lot of it just whisks past the general audience. But one of the things that was blowing me away in the movie Avatar, in the world, there are even different kinds of 3D things that they have. Like they have like the traditional Star Wars holographic 3D image, like when they're looking at the 3D image of the tree. Yeah, okay, that's one thing. And that's kind of obvious. But one of the more subtle things is in some of the ships and in the base, there are like flat screens that they have here and there that are flat 2D screens to the touch, like to the character's touch, but they display 3D images on their 2D screens. Awesome. And you would see it, and you're seeing like their 3D from your own third person point of view. It's kind of mind-boggling.
And as,
I was telling people, it's like it reminds
you. As your camera shifts.
Yes.
As your camera shifts, their 3D moves in relationship to how yours is moving, but it's not right.
Exactly, and it's mind-bending.
Yeah. So it's like,
it's mind-bending. Because you just described it, but to me it reminds me of when I was like in calculus and they would talk about like 10th dimensional objects and like your brain can't even comprehend like what the hell does that even mean. And I was trying to tell people you're seeing 3D in 3D. And that sounds kind of stupid. When you just say it, it's like, what does that mean, stupid? But and that's what I'm saying. It's so hard to wrap your head around. And I think other people were just seeing it and they didn't even realize what they were actually seeing. Yeah. It just completely went like right over the head. But, and I
agree.
Just like,
I think even on a
do that, you know, it's like they
on a even on a simpler note. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
I was gonna say even on a simpler note, something as simple as subtitles when the characters were talking,
They
were starting to they were in 3D and they were slightly overlapping characters. I've never heard an audience ooh over subtitles. And they did in this
watch. Yes, I felt the same way about the subtitles. Yes.
That like mind-bending experience, so many times where there are little things like that. I don't know if it happened with you guys too, but the crowd kind of gasped when the doctor takes one of the UI elements where he's looking at the brain and he's talking about it, and he literally pulls it off
and
of one of the big screens.
And he flips it
to his personal kind of one, and it does the same thing that you're talking about, where we're looking at the brain, and the brain is transitioning in 3D as he swaps it over. And I don't think anybody really realized what was going on, but it was so visceral, and it was just like a one little second thing. Everybody, the crowd actually gasped when that happened.
Wow.
And that was like the simplest,
tiny thing. Exactly. This is what happens in James Cameron's movies, where he has this amazing technology, and he goes right by it. He doesn't.
Yeah.
He knows what it can do, and he can show you what it can do. But it's not about that, and he knows it's not about that. I mean, this story had so many elements and so many layers visually in the story but he didn't dwell on any of this. And he could. I mean, you could have taken 20 minutes just on that guy flipping, you know, that data off the screen and putting it on his pad. Yeah. But he didn't because, you know, he was telling the story and the story needed to move on at that point, and he did. But I mean, like you say, there are more and more amazing things to look at in this movie, and I'm going back again tomorrow to see it. And literally, but it's wondrous because, you know, you could see it four or five times just to get all of to pull all that visual stuff out of it. And I mean, the story is it simple? Yeah. But I like the fact that it works though because it's correct. You know, what other story are you gonna tell with these characters? And I think
if you're making a $300 million experiment, you have to play something safe. And when he's doing so many things that have never been done and are that cutting edge, you make a story that's that acceptable and that open. You know, you're not making a Jarmusch film or a Wim Wenders film. You're making something that needs to make $300 million back. But what you guys were saying, I totally agree with. He does something about taking – I think this is something George Lucas used to do when he lost. He's able to take the extraordinary – it makes it completely mundane and ordinary, and that makes everything like this, like half step away, super tangible, feels like it's the real world, where you're like, I want to keep on seeing that cool thing that you just did, but the camera goes by because it's not important. That's the world we live in. And that I
that's
love that
aliens.
About the movie. Yeah, it's that's, every that's single movie
aliens.
He's done.
It's Terminator.
Terminator 2.
It does these things. I mean, you know, oh boy, how does that amazing alien move and change shape? Polynomial ally. Okay, fine. Let's move on.
Unobtainium. Like, do we even explain what unobtainium was? You know, I looked that up, though. Unobtainium is a scientific term for a hypothetical like mineral that solves problems that we haven't solved yet. And to be honest, there's a bunch of other names that are actually tossed around in the scientific world that are cheesier than that. But unobtainium is like a legitimate scientific term.
Yeah.
It sounds funny, but it also explains a lot.
It's unobtainium, and it's $2 million a kilo. And if you pull out a metric ton...
But that's just like saying it's a regular old anomaly. I mean, you got to call it something a little better.
No,
I think unobtainium is great.
Especially, again, how everybody else in the universe just lets it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody giggled at that. It was like, uptight, that is ridiculous. It was a little giggle.
Because when you think about it, somebody said, oh, you know, what would be cool here is if we had some unobtainium, we could, like, actually use that to solve this problem. And then somebody came out and somebody found a mineral that fit the parameters of the unobtainium. They said, oh, this is unobtainium. Let's use this. And they just started calling it unobtainium. You know, that's how it happened in the story of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean,
I think there's one other thing too.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, I think there's one other thing in line with what you were talking about, Will, is that the motion capture, obviously, they did an incredible job. All the animation is the first time we've gotten past the uncanny valley. But
exactly.
The camera system and the way that that James Cameron was working, they motion captured the camera as well. And at any time, James Cameron could say – that I think is one of the most interesting things in terms of the way it's going to change filmmaking is that James Cameron could be sitting there shooting Zoe, shooting the main lead, all the people in the actual motion capture suits. But he could say at any time, where I'm standing right now, put me in a helicopter a mile away with a telephoto lens. And he would actually have his kind of little motion captured looking camera. And through his lens, he would be seeing kind of a video game style interpretation of those characters as the Na'vi live on the set as he's actually shooting. And then he could tell him, no, you know what, put me where I'm standing right now a mile above everybody. Or, you know what, make me a close-up on Zoe. So he can get whatever he wants at any time.
Put us in a bunch of trees and let me move through the trees and around them and over the rocks and everything.
And not look at Zoe and not look at the actual actors, but see a good approximation. And the amazing thing about all this is that after all the actors are done and they've done their 7, 8, 10 takes for every single shot, everybody can go away and Cameron can stay there with a couple of people on set and he can reshoot and reshoot and reshoot because he has all the positional data and he can try as many times as he wants to until he gets exactly just the right shot.
Wow.
And it's completely worked over on set and then those things get sent to the editing crew. But to me, that's kind of another little unsung hero of the whole thing is that he's not beholden anymore to the one take or the two takes or the three takes physically that were captured on tape or captured digitally. He can rework it as many times as he wants. And I think that's where a lot of the intricate kind of staging and all the geography of those shots, because he could change it as many times as he wants, everything felt like very easy to read, even in all the chaos of dragons flying in the air or tons of guys fighting on the ground. I always knew where I was at all the time whenever I was watching a fight. And that's something I think we lost in the newest Star Wars and a lot of other action scenes in other movies.
Well, see, I think this is part of Lucas's approach to this is doing the he's taking pieces of takes where he'll take, you know, somebody moving through a scene, and, oh, that guy was a little slow. Let's stop him here, slow him down a little bit, or maybe we have that other take. We can cut that other take in here. Oh, that's better. So, and he's putting these images together. Now Cameron can bring it, and he can do the best take possible and go, oh, but my camera was terrible. Oh, let's go through it again. Let's try it again and do exactly what you say. Yeah, I think – and again, that – isn't like, oh my god, it's so amazing. That's like, they can do that in video games.
Exactly what I was thinking. Exactly. I was going to ask, is this like being able to shoot your own video with, I guess, you know, game avatars and being able to position them the way you want to, even with their capture? And that is amazing. I didn't know that was what I was seeing. I don't think anybody
else. No. Yeah, it's Matchroom times 300 million is what it is.
Yeah, I think that's a playground someone like Will and I would definitely want to jump into right away if someone gets the chance to.
So this stuff is not accessible.
We've been talking about that already.
But, it's not accessible yet, but I think that I keep on thinking, what would it be like to be Steven Spielberg, Edgar Wright, anybody who's like on the docket to start making a movie in the next 2 months? If I sat down in the theater right now and I had everything planned out, I knew I was going to make a movie, and I sat down and watched Avatar, I'd have to be just shaking my head saying, man, we need to stop. I need to figure out how to do this. And let's wait like 6 months till I can do it this way. Yeah, because like that's where
people
this. Say – yeah, that's the game-changing stuff. I think the game-changing things are the immersive environment from 3D, the Uncanny Valley destroying, you know, character animation.
What does that mean?
The actual way. Uncanny Valley is the whole idea. Will, you might be able to explain
zombies
it better,
with the empty eyes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The closer you get to reality, the crazier it gets.
Yeah. And it's farther and farther. As you get closer and closer to making it as real as you possibly can, it gets farther and farther away of being convincing.
Especially dealing with humans in particular, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, watch Christmas Carol if you get it.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Watch Christmas Carol.
Well, yeah, neither will I. But and this is why. But you watch The Incredibles or Up, mm-hmm. and all the humans are stylized. That is to throw this off because you want to make it look like human, but not entirely like a human, because mm-hmm. that gives you that little wiggle room to get to be convincing, even though it's not convincing.
Right. That's why people cry during Up, but they don't cry during Final Fantasy.
Exactly. Yeah. Final Fantasy is a really good example because
they cry
for other reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think they use all the technology and everything they possibly could to get that movie to be perfect, but mm-hmm. they forgot, they didn't use any heart to make it
right.
perfect. And mm-hmm. I bring it onto heart and you know, these abstract concepts that mm-hmm. make these, that sell these films. And say what you will about Cameron, because a lot of people say, oh, God, he's an idiot, and I hate working for him.
People say that.
But he is a genius, and he doesn't, like Ryan was saying, you know, he'll go in there, and he'll go over it and over it and over it. He will. He literally mm-hmm. will do that. He went on the Abyss. Mm-hmm. were doing dives underwater, and he'd redo shots and redo shots, and he'd stay mm-hmm. under too long. He'd have to decompress to come up. So the man is totally committed to his movies. And, you know, he is. I think he's a little, thank God, a little bit backed off from that. But mm-hmm.
He waives his director's fee a lot of times. I mean, that's how much he believes
in
the movies.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the rumor that he put money into this movie and he waived his director's fee. And he'll get, literally, he is last in line to get paid with anything that comes back from this movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's a lot of cash. But I probably shouldn't say his name, but I know a person who worked on the film from 2005. And when I was talking to him in 2005, oh, yeah, I'm working with Jim Cameron. We're doing this thing. It's really complex, and we're doing all this, you know, stuff. And this guy works in Lightwave, by the way. Hey, well, you know. So... And then he's doing that, and then he makes a movie, and he was one of the leads on one of the environment things. But, it's so shockingly good that I think literally you miss what you're looking at. And the other thing is, it's the application of technologies, too. Like we say, the motion capture invented 1962, this visualization in the camera, not new technology, but it's him going, oh, wait, if we use this and then we use that and then we use that and we put it together, that could be really cool. And that's what he's doing. He's giving you or us, you know, I say us because I'm trying to work in this field, but the tools. He's giving us a new set of tools. Here's a new set of tools, and here's something where you can do it better. I find that motion capture is really cool in that it opens up the world and you can do whatever you need to do and you run around people with cameras and all that great stuff, but it doesn't ground you in the real world. So you, if you're grounded in the real world, you're going to say, oh, wait, but we can't really run there because they're like tall things or we trip over them. Or people would see us run through them, and it would make sense, or something like that, you know. And it gives you the ability to, you're here in this space. How do you want to film it? It's not, hey, you can be anywhere, because that opens up too many possibilities of oh, let's do something really cool and really amazing that will really suck.
Well, some people feel.
And I think too many. Well, not too many. I will say that. And part of people are going to look at this movie and they're going to say, oh, it's a piece of crap because they didn't get $300 million and they don't have, and they didn't have the vision to see this movie coming. Mm-hmm. I would like to think I had a vision of what movies were going to be. And then I saw this movie and then I was tangentially thrown off.
And see, I think a lot of the,
oh, wow,
a lot of the
pretty impressive.
I think a lot of the critics really, the ones who are more critical and don't really see what the big deal is about this movie, I think they really haven't, it's too new right now. They haven't really come to terms with the idea. Because you know, a lot of people are throwing out, you know, this is going to change movies forever. I think a lot of people don't even understand what that simple statement means. Because think about it. Like what someone was saying earlier about the other filmmakers like Spielberg and others looking at Avatar and saying, I got to get some of this. You just think about it. You know, studios out there, when they see how it looks, I mean, they're going to be like, what? We're making the new Batman movie? We want it like this. Mm-hmm. You know? Exactly. Think about it.
You want it to be an Avatar
now,
movie.
Now, think about other great franchises we all know and love, or some of us do. I mean, there's the comic book movies, like I just stated. Imagine some of the great movies recently if they had been redone in 3D. Imagine if Star Trek was in 3D of this level. Imagine if District 9 was in 3D of this level.
Ooh.
Just imagine what that would bring to the table for all these movies that we already think are great. I mean,
imagine if The Hobbit gets made in 3D.
Imagine if Megan Fox was in 3D and
Oh, hush it, Aaron.
Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
There's two things guaranteed when we get together and we do a podcast. Lightwave will get mentioned and Megan Fox will get mentioned.
This is video log 12 times 2132. Do I have to do this now? Like, I really need to get some rag.
No, now, when it's fresh.
Okay, location, shack. And the days are starting to blur together.
On do.
The language is a pain, but, you know, I figure it's like field stripping a weapon. Just repetition.
Nari.
Nari.
Doing it all stronger.
Leitiri calls me Scown. It means moron.
This is a very important part of it.
Norm's attitude has improved lately.
I see you, but it's not just I'm seeing you in front of me. It's I see into you. I see.
It's good he's back on board, but he thinks I'm a Scown too.
I understand you.
So I was really impressed. Like, I'm looking at some of the really big, high resolution pictures of the movie, and I am just so impressed with, like, their braids, the feathers, the sunglass helmet things, the ears, the nose. Everything looks spectacular.
Can I tell you what really impressed me? If you've got the poster, which is basically Sam Worthington's character, his Avatar character, and you can look at his eye.
Mm-hmm.
Go really close in on that eye and look at the reflections coming out of the eye and see how detailed they are. And see how... And it's like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
And know that those are in every shot.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the level at which things start to hurt.
But I was just looking. That is awesome. I did not notice that until you mentioned it. But that and the hair follicles.
Look at the lighting. They're looking out, looking at lighting that's coming from lights that aren't. You know, they're actually lit with lights that aren't there.
That's genius,
isn't it?
My God, this thing is just.
I know it's
beyond.
Yeah. It keeps going. It gets more intense and more depth of just more depth in that incredible field where you're there, where you're in that movie, and it's so much cool. I have to talk to my sister and talk her into letting me take my niece to see the movie because
I was thinking about that too.
This was my,
how
this
old
what
are
I
they?
Want to talk about. My niece is six.
Okay, I got nine and six.
Nine and six. I think you should do it. I think you should. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing in that movie that is untoward. There's nothing too scary, I don't think. I mean, you have to know your six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But there isn't.
Well, I let them see Transformers too, and
that
was a nightmare. So this.
Oh, that's a piece of crap.
Yeah, there's no humping robots in this one.
No, the no humping robots. Is no cross humanoid robot sex. No, you know, none of that. So
this has got to be the most all ages James Cameron movie.
I believe when she's 20 or when she's 29, she has her little kids, and you know, and they say, well, we're gonna go see the latest 3D movie. You know, we're gonna go see the latest movie because they're all being 3D by that point. And she'll be able to go, hey, you know, I remember when my Uncle Will took me to see Avatar. And they'll go, no. Really?
Yeah, it's kind of like when people say, I saw Star Wars in the theater. You know, yep. I think that's what iSmart is.
Hey, hands up. I did too. I mean, I saw.
No, I didn't, but I'm just saying.
No, neither did I.
I'm old enough, people. I rode my bike. I was 12 years old. I rode my bike to see Star Wars not once, not twice, but eight
times. That's awesome.
All I know is I was
my friend beat me. He went 11. He went 15.
Eric was still in the womb.
Yeah, I think I was still an idea.
I was in the womb. But I mean, I was
children. I'm playing with children. Okay.
What? What'd you say, Ryan?
I was gonna say that I have a lot of friends that are like 4 or 5 years older than me, and they told me the same thing, that like their older brothers would take them when they're little to see Star Wars, and that moment that first Star Destroyer comes over your head,
yeah,
and it's kind of like, what in the world is happening? Like, that was a moment that like the world changed for people our age.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but
I think
don't know if
is.
You guys remember the very first
two
shots.
What you see it in 3D, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
That's exactly what I was gonna say. The first two shots of Avatar do an incredible job of teaching you how to watch the movie and what the movie is gonna be like. The very first shot is, I think, Sam Worthington looking right at us, but he's completely out of focus, and we just see these two little things kind of floating. And that teaches us like what the shallowest, tightest like depth of field is gonna be. And then the next shot is like the deepest focus, staring all the way down the entire space station as all of these guys slowly start coming out. And for me, in terms of like immersion, and this is something totally different than anything I've ever seen, I can go from something infinitesimally small and focus just on that, or I can have this deep, incredible sense of focus and just with my eyes start searching all over within a frame. And those two shots, and being the first two shots, were totally like, we've entered a new world for filmmaking. And I think that that's almost exactly the same as seeing this huge Star Destroyer fly over me and have no idea what's going on.
Wow, hearing you speak about it like that, I got chills.
No, I completely agree. That is so perfect, the way he just laid that out.
Yeah,
those opening
that was
shots.
Awesome.
That is absolutely, you know, I believe the director's intent, and it is so perfect. So poetic.
Yeah, it was. Wow. Okay, well, let's just talk about the movie itself. I mean, I know we were talking about it from, you know, technical and whatever, but it was a sweet story. I mean, I know I haven't seen Dances with Wolves. I'm like one of like five people that hasn't seen it. It was just a simple. it was just.
I think
simple
I was forced love. To in school to watch it.
Oh, in school, that sucks.
Yeah.
But so I didn't really have that many. I didn't have that big. I mean, it was a simple story, yeah. But
yeah. Did you buy the love story? I think that's a big thing that tells us if the animation, if the characters were.
Did
you feel like there was really love?
I did, totally.
It was major chemistry.
Yeah, I hate to admit it, but I feel I really did.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
especially if they took us on the journey of her, you know, first meeting him, you're a baby, and then they walk, and you can see the progression of how they would fall in love. So, yeah, I bought it.
Yeah.
And they made me
shot that. The shot that sold it for me, that if we didn't have the like 2 hours of build up before this, it would have looked ridiculous and like a cartoon. I think the true test of it working is when she finally got in, and when Neytiri got in and found Jake as a human, and we have this what could potentially be a really awkward shot of this like 12-foot blue creature cradling this like tiny little crippled guy. I didn't watch it and like laugh or giggle or like that just looks strange. I totally bought it. Like,
I love
it. She knows, and she's cool with it. And I was thinking about it later. I'm like, that's a shot. If you would have just showed a still to me of that moment before I ever saw the movie and didn't have the 2 hours of buildup of their relationship, I would have laughed at it. You know, like, you're like, what in the hell is this? Is this bad anime? Like, what is it? But because of the 2 hours that came before it and like the choices he made, I totally, like I said, I hate admitting it, but I totally bought it. I totally was like, wow, this kind of sucks. Like, I hope it pulls up.
Well, I got to say, in that shot also, technically, you know, I was popping back and forth, and technical, not technical.
It's okay.
But I really like that part of the film emotionally. And then I'm looking and going, oh my fucking God, look at the Na'vi flesh next to the human flesh.
Yes. Oh my God.
100%.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know if it was... Well, the other thing that where I lost kind of what I was watching was there's so much in the section where it's human Na'vi, where they didn't interact, that when they were in the fight and they're firing arrows... I'm forgetting these arrows are four to 5 inches around, and they're going through people's chests.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh yeah, they're rather large, aren't they? I forget about that.
Yeah, well, and I guess the bigness of the Na'vi versus the human reminds me of Lord of the Rings and the little Hobbit and Gandalf, you know, that kind of scene. But she was actually touching him. And not only was that good visually, I'm glad that she as a character got to see who she fell in love with, you know, how was on physically, you know, how he looked or whatever. And that a person like that with, you know, a disability like that had the heart of a warrior. A fierce one.
Right, exactly.
And so I just really love that.
The amazing, I mean, you know, Zoe, I mean, you know, Uhura is, you know, as an amazing show. A lot of the people that see, CCH Pounder, is that her name?
Uh-huh.
I recognized her.
I didn't.
I went, wait a minute, I know her. Where do I know her from? No, I know her. And she got the weird nose. And then I saw her name in the crowd. I said, oh, that's where she's from. Because I'm a big fan of the Shield. Really, she did an amazing job in the Shield.
And she was on Warehouse 13.
I was going to say Warehouse 13. Yeah.
Do we always have to go back to the science fiction?
Yeah, but I didn't recognize Zoe. To me, Sigourney Weaver's Avatar was the most spot on for me.
Yeah.
Oh man, I got in an argument with someone about that actually, right? Like somebody was telling me that they're like, it doesn't look like a Na'vi. It looks way too much like Sigourney Weaver. For one, that was the first shot that I ever saw on Avatar Day before the movie, where I was like, this movie might be something special. Because it was the first time I saw it where I was like, wow, this isn't special effects. This is like using visual effects to do makeup that you never could do in real life.
Yes,
like this isn't just doing it to do it. The only reason that you couldn't do this is because makeup is an additive process. It's not reductive. Like you can't take volume away from someone. But in CG, you can do that. You can elongate these people. You can make them thinner. And you can never do that in makeup. You always have to add on. But when I first saw that Sigourney Weaver shot and I could see her eyes and see her face, I'm like, man, this, I have to make sure I see this. But I got in an argument with someone because they're like, oh, it looks too much like Sigourney Weaver. I'm like, no, there is like a reason in the story for it, because she was one of the first avatars. And the thing that's weird about the human Na'vis is that they're not exactly just like the actual native Na'vis. Like they have five fingers or four fingers and a thumb, but the Na'vis have four, more like monkey kind of hands.
Oh,
I think Sigourney Weaver was probably, like, if you're trying to get in the canon or reason it away, was probably one of the very first mixes, and that one had more human DNA than Na'vi DNA.
I believe you're totally right. I believe that is on the money.
And I think that was definitely 100% thought about. It may never have been said, but just like the same way we never get a really good reason as to why the humans are so desperate for the unobtainium until like 2 minutes before the movie's done, they don't feel like they have to explain anything. And the movie, that is the one thing I did like about the story, is that for it being almost 3 hours long, it was rapid fire. Like it didn't stop to sit and have like narrative scenes all that often to say, here's the world, here's the technology, it didn't have to explain itself. It was for a 3-hour movie, it was really lean. And
I was also I was shocked at how quickly they got him, Sam Worthington, into his avatar.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, what, 10 minutes? I think he had 10 minutes out of the avatar, and then he was in there. Like, whoa.
Running around, didn't care anything.
Yeah,
and I
appreciated that, too. You know.
Yeah, it was the anti-King Kong. It didn't take an hour to see the movie.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I like that, the anti-King Kong. Yeah.
It took forever to see that. don't remind me.
I love King Kong, shut up.
Okay, I'll shut
up. I did too, but to be honest, that's one of the reasons why I love the Skull Island stuff. That's why I kind of like Pandora so much, because it was almost like an even bigger version of Skull Island.
Yeah, and the floating mountains.
Oh man, those things.
That.
Yeah, who knew
a mountain theme park with floating mountains?
I want that. Because you're climbing up this.
Oh, Eric, tell us about.
And there's sweating and stuff. Great.
Eric and I was kind of talking about it a little bit before. And
at
he was trying
length.
At length, okay. when we talk about the floating mountains, he was really telling me about how the a lot of thought went into the world building and how.
Oh, yeah.
the planets float because of gravity. Go into that, Eric.
Well, oh man, it has to be one of the most in-depth alien fantasy worlds we've ever seen on film before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, I told Kat, you know, again, I think people are just glossing over this, just like they're glossing over everything else in the 3D. I mean, think about sci-fi, because obviously it's sci-fi movies that go off-world. Think about any off-world places you've seen on television or in motion pictures. How often do they have, first of all, a climate that isn't quite Class M? I mean, that's a simple thing right off the bat. You know, a non, you know, Earth-like atmosphere. That's not even common. Okay, we have the different scale due to the different gravity on Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
How often in sci-fi off-world locations does the planet have the same climate or environment planet-wide? You know, it's all too common.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it works fine in Star Wars with Tatooine and Hoth and Dagobah. That's all well and good. But, is Earth like that in any way? You know, our own planet?
No.
And so here we have, you know,
I agree so much
with that. And then I was telling Kat about how thought out the biology was of the animals on the planet, how it made sense in their world, how almost every major creature we see, like what on our planet would be the equivalent of mammals, I guess, they're all, what do you call it?
Six-legged.
I was going to say sexpedal or whatever. But they all, they're all six-limbed pretty much around, all the way around, except for the Na'vi. Yeah, and I mean, as all the ground creatures, the panther-like creature, the rhino-like creatures, the horse-like creatures, but even going into, I believe, even the flying creatures are six-limbed as well.
I think so.
Yeah, and it just all makes sense.
Two sets of wings, certainly.
Biology all kind of makes sense, unlike some random alien creatures. I mean, no offense to the new Star Trek, which I love, but that red creature on the ice planet in Star Wars, I mean, how does that fit? You know, like, why is it red? You know, and
because it was supposed to be a Cloverfield monster, maybe.
It doesn't make hardly any biological sense, that creature.
Yeah.
You know, but
I agree.
Go ahead.
No.
I was gonna say I can't agree with you more. I feel like Avatar makes like Star Wars look like it was put together by a kid. Like everything. No, I really believe it though. Like no, because everything in Avatar exists for a reason, and there's a reason behind why it looks the way it does, why it acts the way it does. And all of that ties back into the story, the fact that all the plants are basically like networked together and that the memories of the dead, you know, people are stored within the planet. Now, like
I
if you care
that.
About any of that stuff, like Gaia theory or anything, just naturalistic, like all those things were there for a reason. They weren't there just because that would look cool or I can't figure out what I want to do in my story. So I'll just make a creature that does this. You know, like they were there for a reason. They weren't there just arbitrarily or because you're a poor story writer.
And then the floating mountains, I know the floating mountains seem a little bit crazy, but I mean, I said a lot of people don't realize that they mention it multiple times in the movie. Well, I think they mentioned it, but Pandora is like a moon planet. It's it's orbiting that big,
that
big blue, oh, they show it many times, but there's orbiting like that big blue Jupiter looking like planet. And I'm sure there's some kind of crazy something mucking with the gravity there. And then not only that, but I mean, there's strange ores and substances like unobtainium. We don't know like what kind of ore.
You know what I really liked about those floating mountain is the way the water flowed down from them. They didn't flow all the way down to the ground. They kind of evaporated.
Yeah.
I love that. That was just so beautiful.
Well, yeah.
I believe
so,
the mountains.
So what you're saying
like
is
2 minutes earlier. Go ahead, Will.
I was just going to say, what you're saying is you have unobtainium on the ground, you've got obsidian in the mines.
Nice.
I read that in somebody's review online somewhere.
Rocky and Bullwinkle, thank you!
I was going to say that I believed it because 2 minutes earlier we saw unobtainium floating. So I figured if there's unobtainium in the mountains and there's some kind of magnetic flux that screws with everybody's like that was kind of interesting that they actually went out of their way to show the unobtainium floating. They show the mountains floating. They mention that there's this magnetic flux zone, and then that plays into the story. There's a reason why they have to go visual. They can't go guided. And, you know, they use the environment to balance the playing field, which goes back into the whole point of the story in the first place. Like all that stuff was there for a reason. Even if it's too pretty and too poetic and it all matches for a simple story like this, it all worked really well.
Yeah.
And there was some kind of rhythm to it. You know, unlike Star Wars, which just does whatever it's going to do.
You know, and then also, because I feel like the biggest thing now when I talk about Avatar is just to combat the naysayers out there, like the, again, the critics.
He's been battling people all over.
I don't. I think that might be a waste of time, because there's people who get it, some people who never will.
Well, again, I don't blame them, because again, it's only been out, you know, worldwide for, you know, the last couple days. I think this will all bear out in time eventually. I think it's just too new now. But, because, you know, like I said, even if you strip away the groundbreaking effects and everything, the visuals, and I know everyone keeps saying, you know, it's a relatively simple story. Yeah, we all understand that too. But there's still yet more that you would find in a more traditional film, meaning not a effects-heavy film. And, like, something I got, and it's just, like, again, too new to really take it all in yet, but something I'm going to plagiarize from a comment review I saw, like, on Rotten Tomatoes that somebody posted was, because this is some of the first bit of symbolism I've got to start to think about in the movie, but for instance, someone said, come on, you know, think about it. The very first shot we see is, like, Sam Worthington, and we see him wake from the cryo sleep, and he opens, like, one eye. And then, at the very final shot of the film, you see Sam Worthington in his new permanent Na'vi body, and he opens both eyes. And the major theme throughout the film, if you think about it, it works on many multiple levels, is she says, you know, we say, I see you. But it doesn't just mean I see you in the traditional human sense. It's a much deeper meaning. Right. The whole movie works on the visual level. You have to see it, but not see it in the traditional way that we understand seeing. It's in a deeper level. It's not just a two-dimensional film. It's a three. And I don't mean this visually. I mean it's makeup. Wow. It's a three-dimensional film. There is more dimensions than just the visual. It's much deeper.
I think I misspoke earlier. Then I think I agree with you. I think it was a simple plot, but I don't think it was a simple story. If that makes any sense.
So amazing! Yeah, so amazing. Yeah, exactly. With one eye, you can only see in 2D. With two eyes, you can see in 3D.
That is wow.
And see, that's just the beginning, you know, of people analyzing it. There's so much more outside of the effect.
Yeah, there's a ton of. Yeah, I was reading somebody, I won't take credit for this, but the word Na'vi, if you take out the letters E and T, it would have meant native. Aliens.
I was thinking of that on my own, just earlier today. It's like native, because I was thinking of Native Americans, of course. And then, as I was telling Kat earlier, this is my own thing, I didn't plagiarize this from anyone, but I mean, not just the ICU theme, but also just the Avatar theme. Yes, we all know this has been, you know, explored in other things like Matrix and other things like that. But the Avatar thing is working on multiple levels as well, because obviously we have the Jake character in his Na'vi avatar. But of course the humans have their technological equivalent in like the more modern, they were called exosuits and aliens, but they have their essentially
AMP suit
avatars.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but even the Na'vi themselves have their own avatars in the way they link up with their creatures.
Right.
It's an extension of who they are. And see, you know, it's like, God, it's almost too much. It's almost too much.
there's also the part when he wakes up first in the cryo sleep, when he's those bits are flying around him. I don't want to say what those would be. But they're kind of, and they kind of glow, and they're kind of floating around him, and you find out he's in zero gravity, and that's why the thing's floating around him. But then, when he wakes up on Pandora, he wakes up, looks around, and there are things floating around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just a part of the planet. So that was a definite callback to that part in the beginning of the story. It's definitely. It's those kinds of things that hit at different levels.
And for this to be that groundbreaking, game-changing movie of supposedly ushering the new era of cinema, I mean, it's so appropriate, these themes that we're talking about, with about opening your eyes and seeing what's really there, what's really possible, the things that are beyond just being your regular everyday self, that you can really take things to another level. It works on so many levels in the real world, you know, with, you know, probably James Cameron thinking in his own life. It works for everybody. It works for the world. It works for the industry. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's completely ridiculous.
Well, part of this movie is, and we're all saying it because I think we all believe it, is that go out and see it in IMAX 3D, go out and see it in 3D. We're not saying, hey, when this comes out on video, it's going to be amazing. We're going,
no,
go out and see it. Because the concept is make as much money for them as possible, go out and see it in the most expensive format there is. You know, and I mean, cynically, you could say that, but it's actually, you know, he's punching the ticket. He's giving us a bang for the buck.
That's
the thing.
That's where I go back to the first thing I said, is where he made three. This is the first time that 3D isn't a gimmick to take your money. It's absolutely essential to the viewing experience. Mm-hmm. It's part of the story. It's part of the characters that you
need to be there and
be immersed on the planet.
Yeah, I agree with that. Up was the first time it was done correctly, 3D, and this is the first time it was essential to the story. I do definitely agree with that.
Well, to the experience.
Yes, exactly.
To the story in this way, I think it's essential as well.
I think it all ties in again.
It really all ties in.
He doesn't do...
I think you feel the movie more, though, with the 3D.
Exactly. He doesn't do things halfway. He commits to them.
As I told Kat earlier, I think the 3D is essential to this movie as the new technology of Technicolor was to Wizard of Oz as a film.
And they used that. Yeah.
That is the best thing you could say to a naysayer. That right there.
That's why you have to go to the theater and see it. And I think that's why it has a chance at maybe not beating the money of Titanic, but being in the theaters for 3, 4, 5 months, which these days is unheard of.
Yeah, that is.
Oh, yeah. A month is unheard of nowadays. Well, they just did, I saw an estimate of $72 million. That means they only have to have 8 weeks of $72 million to break even.
The other thing, though, too, is this thing's going to clean up worldwide. I was a little worried at the end of the movie that,
I'm not worried about the movie.
Audience. Well, the American audience that this would need to really, like, break lots and lots of records over the long haul, I don't know how many, like, that third percentage of the states wants to watch an anti-war, completely green, pro-ecology, pro-environment, kind of anti-American, or at least the current anti-American idea.
Three or four times. Anti-aggressive American.
Anti-commercialism, anti...
Yeah.
Never underestimate the shallowness of Americans as well. We want to see, a pretty movie. We want to see something amazing.
I'm glad you said that. But I want to say, too, on that point, about the political point, because me personally, I am not the... I'm not the most enthusiastic person when it comes to, like, green movement type things. No, I'm pro-green, but not pro-green movement, you know?
Right.
And I come at it from that point of view, and I'm also, God, you know, I couldn't be you couldn't hardly find a more pro-military person, like, as I am in everyday life. But that being said, and I was a little bit trepidatious about that going into this movie because I knew the general themes. But, I mean, the way it's presented in the actual movie, when you actually watch it, if you get over any preconceived prejudice you might have going in, it does not conflict with any of that in any way, as far as I'm concerned. In other words, if you're pro-military, let's say not so happy about, you know, great on the green movement, if that's your belief going in, I don't really think this movie, I don't think you really have anything to disagree with after you actually watch it, because... Obviously, whether it's the United States or the Earth's military, if it ever ends up the way it's portrayed in this movie, who would be pro that? I mean, come on.
Right.
Of course you're going to be against it. You know, of course, given presented the makeup and construction of this fantasy world we're given, and not just Pandora, but the fantasy future of humankind, I mean, no one's going to be for that. You have to be rooting against it. You have to be rooting for the quote-unquote good guys. And I think it's pretty clear, it's not really ambiguous who's morally good or not. It's pretty clear who is good and right in this situation, in the movie, as it's presented. So mm-hmm. I have no qualms. It's all good. I have nothing to argue with, you know, from a political point of view, watching the movie. No, it's I don't see why anyone really would, unless you really are, because whether you believe corporations, you can pick and choose which may be or may not be evil in real life, but as far as the movie's concerned, I think they're pretty evil, and I think everyone should pretty much be on board with that. So...
Yes. Well, they're desperate. So I try to see it from their side, and they're desperate for this unobtainium so they can do whatever they have to do. So you just try to look at it and say, how could you see it from their eyes? But then at one point, you're just like, okay, I can't do it anymore. Screw them.
And you can just give them a pass because they're obviously all, you know, ignorant in their own world, the humans for the most part. Even Jake was himself in the beginning, of course, until he had this experience. So, you know.
Well, I think that this mentality exists now. They were talking about how, life on Mars, right? The whole thing is we're trying to discover life on Mars. We're trying to discover if there's water on the moon. Why are we trying to do that? For the scientific adventure of it.
No,
because
we want
life on the Mars. Because if there was life on Mars, there probably is petroleum on Mars.
Oh, sure. And
if there's petroleum on Mars, the fastest group of the you will see space technology quadruple in 10 years because we'll get up there and we'll bring it back.
Yes, and just because I say it's
exploitative. That's
yeah,
why.
Just because I say, you know, the story and construct of Avatar is a fictional fantasy. Of course, it's grounded in the world around us as all great sci-fi is. Yeah, of course, you know, and that's fine too as well. You know, nothing wrong with that either.
Well, my thing is, I wouldn't worry about Lil Jim in a small movie because it's doing amazing box office, obviously, but it's also going to be the first 3D Blu-ray disc.
Right.
They put out the spec, and that's going to come out late next year. I think about the time that the DVD players for it and TVs for it come out. So you'll be able to watch Avatar in 3D at home as long as you buy a new TV and a new TV. Okay. Maybe not practical. I mean, you know, it's a $7,000 Avatar set. And we'll throw in the movie. Look at this. We're throwing in the movie.
Okay, guys. I want to get some final thoughts on Avatar, if you have any, so we can wrap this up. This is, I don't know how long this one's going to be. final thought, Ryan.
We said it a little bit earlier, but Wizard of Oz, 2001, Star Wars, Avatar. That's it.
Okay. Eric?
Well, my final thought is we are not done talking about this. This is going to keep reverberating, like, among our own personal conversations and in the podcasts to come in the future, because I was thinking about this also earlier. Think about it. Now we know what it would have been like if podcasts existed in 1977. Because you would not just talk about, you know, 3 months ago, wow, Logan's Run is really great. All of a sudden, here comes Star Wars.
Okay, it didn't have the power of Jaws, I don't think, because, I mean, Star Wars, I mean, what's that about? I mean, what's the guy leaving at the end? I mean, what's that? Was it going to make a sequel now?
So, yeah, if you try to imagine podcasting in 1977, you're not going to talk about this, you know, for 1 week and move on. No,
I'd be calling you a job sucker.
It's going to be reversed.
I think you should anyway.
All right, Will, last thoughts.
Last thought. See the fracking film.
In 3D.
In 3D.
If you see it in anything else, you're being ripped off.
Indeed, I have to agree.
Yeah. You have to go see it at least in 3D, and IMAX 3D is probably the best way. Oh, and I must say, I saw it in I was down close to the screen, and I got to see it, and I got most of the effect, but when I went up to the middle of the theater and watched it from there, off to the side, see it in the middle of the theater. I mean, if you can't get seat down, you know, in the middle of the theater, don't see the film.
See it, but don't see it.
I, Yeah, well, no, no. I mean, walk out and say, I want my money back or I want a ticket for a later show. Because you, it's just, you have to watch it in an optimal position. But yeah, but see the fracking film.
And that, on that note, we end. And thanks, guys. Visit us on sci-fiparty line.com. Give us a call at 773-362. God, never remember that damn number. Give us a call at 773-336-2686. And see you at the party next time. Bye.
Dream, I see you. My light in darkness, breathing hope of new life. Now I live through you and you through me, enchanting. I pray in my heart that this dream never ends.
Almost like looking forward to maybe Will like bringing up something contradictory or who knows what.
I know.